Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy. Socrates, narrated by Lynn Redgrave, Part 8.
Socrates explains how this distortion has occurred by telling the notorious story of the oracle to Chariphon. In attempting to understand the oracle, Socrates had become convinced that the god had assigned him the mission of exposing the ignorance of his fellow Athenians. But this very mission had caused Socrates to be mistrusted and resented, even hated. Young men liked to imitate him, so people said he corrupted the youth. This slander is nothing but the invention of those who wish to hide their shame in being shown to be ignorant.
And whenever someone would ask those who promote the prejudice against me, by doing or teaching what does Socrates corrupt the youth, they have nothing to say, but do not know. And yet, lest they not seem confused, they say those things that are convenient against all philosophers, the things in the air and under the earth, and they do not believe in the gods, and they make the weaker argument the stronger. For I think they would not want to say the truth, that it is being made very clear that while pretending to know, they know nothing. Therefore, inasmuch as they are lovers of honor, and vehement, and many, and speak eagerly and persuasively about me, they have filled your ears for a long time with vehement slanders.
Socrates saw no need to critically investigate the religious beliefs of himself or others while he was philosophizing. Aristotle tells us, and we have every reason to believe him, that Socrates confined his philosophical attentions almost entirely to ethics. Socrates attended to theological issues only as they relate to ethical concerns. In fact, his general lack of interest in discussing religious matters is starkly evident in Plato's dialogue called Phaedrus. Here, Phaedrus expresses skepticism about a popular myth involving Boreas, the god of the north wind. Socrates responds with what many contemporary philosophers would find an astonishing lack of intellectual interest in religion.
And if someone who doesn't believe in these things would seek to explain each of them in accordance with probability by using a bumpkinish sort of wisdom, he will need much leisure. But I have no leisure for these things at all. And the reason, O friend, is this. I cannot yet, as the Delphic inscription has it, know myself. So it seems laughable to me, when I do not know these things, to investigate the still unknown and purposeless. So I do not pursue these things, but in accepting what is believed about them, as I said just now, I investigate not these things, but myself.
Ancient Greek religion was a jumble of myths. For the most part, Socrates unreflectively accepted them and intellectually ignored them. He even regarded the attempt to critically analyze these myths as a type of vanity, or what he called a bumpkinish sort of wisdom for which he had no leisure. This doesn't mean that he believed these myths to be literally true. It means only that he did not bother to consider how and in what sense such myths might be true. Nonetheless, Socrates held certain religious beliefs that did set him apart from his contemporaries. This was especially true of his beliefs about matters where religion and ethics are connected. Nowhere is this more evident than in Plato's Euthyphro. Here, as we've seen, Socrates questions a young man who intends to prosecute his own father, despite the protests of his relatives, who claim that the prosecution is impious. Euthyphro thinks he knows all there is to know about piety and impiety, so he is deaf to the arguments of his relatives. Euthyphro explains to Socrates that his prosecution follows the pattern established by Zeus himself, who bound and mutilated his own divine father for wrongs he had done. At this remark, Socrates breaks in, expressing great doubts that the gods, whom he regards as infinitely wise, could really be guilty of ugly and evil actions. Indeed, he knows of nothing good that has come to humans that has not come from the gods. It is questionable whether the average Athenian believed, as Socrates did, that the gods could do no wrong. Yet Socrates grounded his belief in some of the common Greek myths about the gods, and the problem is that the myths are inconsistent. For example, they often claim that Zeus hates all lies. Then they go on to tell about some deceit for which Zeus is directly responsible. Insofar as Socrates does consider theological reform, it is a consistent and moralizing picture of the divine, a picture that was found only incompletely within the Greek myths of his day. Another example of Socrates' ethical posture toward Greek religion can be seen in his attitude towards the soul and the afterlife. In Socrates' time, stories of the afterlife were filled with inconsistencies. In some stories, the dead were said to uniformly suffer in a dull, grey, never-ending existence. The dead were said to be shades or ghosts, forever filled with longing for the mortal lives they have lost. In other stories of Greek myth, divine judges reward the good and punish the bad, so that the dead are said to achieve a balance of justice that is not always available to the living. Some Athenians suspected that there was no afterlife. Others preferred the view that souls would be reincarnated, either as humans or as other life forms. Perhaps it was because of these inconsistent accounts of the afterlife that Socrates' contemporaries generally feared death. They regarded it as perhaps the worst evil that could happen to them. Socrates mocks such an attitude in Plato's Apology.
The fear of death is nothing but the belief that one is wise when one is not. For it is to believe one knows what one does not know. No one knows whether death happens to be the greatest of all goods for a person. But people fear it, as if they knew it were the greatest of evils. And is this not the most disgraceful sort of ignorance? That of thinking that one knows what one does not know? In this way, I am perhaps different from most people. And if I am wiser in anything, it is this: that not having adequate knowledge about what is in Hades, I do not think I know.
Socrates obviously recognizes that he lacks knowledge about death and the afterlife, but he has reasons not to fear them. His moralized view of the gods is that they will do no evil to good people, either in life or in death. Accordingly, Socrates had an almost cheerful attitude towards his own execution. In Plato's Crito and Gorgias, Socrates makes it clear that he is inclined to accept the stories in which the dead go to Hades, which is a place for judgment. Such stories make it all the more urgent to live the best, most virtuous life possible. Wealth, fame, good looks, or anything else cannot rival the importance of morality in keeping your soul in the best possible condition. Perhaps the most puzzling of Socrates' religious beliefs is his trust in divination as a source of important information. He seems to unwaveringly accept the proclamations of the oracle at Delphi. The god, he says, could never lie. He seems to accept divination in many forms, claiming that the authority of the gods has been made evident to him and others through dreams, oracles, and other tokens of divine power. Socrates is a rationalist, but only to a point. Xenophon summarizes Socrates' view of the relationship between reason and revelation in this way:
what the gods give to us to do through learning, we must learn. What is hidden from mortals, we should try to find out from the god by divination.
Perhaps the most unusual of Socrates' beliefs about divination involved his conviction that he had a private sign or voice. His daimonion, a divine something, as he calls it, warned him to avoid errors that he otherwise would have made. Occasionally, the warnings seem quite trivial, but when Socrates considers why the daimonion opposes him, he usually finds that something significant is at stake, something that Socrates had not noticed until the voice signaled an alert. In some cases, the divine sign seems to have profoundly influenced Socrates' life. Perhaps the most significant example was the opposition that Socrates perceived from his daimonium when he considered a political career. In democratic Athens, political activity was generally expected from an intelligent and ethically concerned citizen. Socrates explained the significance of the opposition from his daimonium in a famous passage in Plato's Apology.
It might seem strange that I go about and mind other people's business, giving advice in private, but don't come before the assembly and advise the state. The reason for this is that something divine comes to me. I have had this since childhood. It is a kind of voice that comes to me. And when it comes, it always holds me back from what I would have done, but never urges me to do anything. This is what opposes my taking up political activity.
Socrates goes on to argue that the daimonion's opposition is a very good thing. He would not have lived as long, nor would he have had as much time to oppose wrongs if he had undertaken his mission in political forums. He surely would have been put to death much earlier by political enemies. It seems clear that Socrates was charged with inventing new gods because he claimed to have a private divinatory sign. But he showed at his trial that his religious belief in his daimonium was entirely earnest. Because of his religious sincerity, he easily countered the prosecution's attempt to portray him as a scientific atheist. The story of Socrates is a peculiar one. On the one hand, he claimed that he did not attend to theological speculations. On the other hand, he worked out a thoroughly moral conception of the gods as omniscient and omnibenevolent, that is, all-knowing and all-kind. Another irony is that Socrates scorned the fear of death, but had no great confidence in his own beliefs about the afterlife. Whatever death holds, Socrates believed it will not be bad for those who have carefully made their souls as good as possible. Socrates characterized himself as a man who has lived the examined life, upholding the life of reason as the best possible life for a human being. And yet he also accepted that oracles, dreams, and signs from the gods are abundant and reliable. He even claimed to have his own personal divine monitor. The same Socrates who gives us the dialectical method of reasoning, a method we still use to test and clarify our philosophical views, is powerfully revealed through his famous paradoxes. Socrates also is forever veiled or hidden to us within those same paradoxes. We may never be in a position to explain why this is so. As Socrates says, we may never know how these things are. But at least we can come to recognize that some views are better than others, and we can strive to identify and live the morally virtuous life that was so all-important to Socrates. It is not surprising that after Socrates was executed, a number of his friends and followers tried to continue his work. Plato and Xenophon are the best-known examples. There were many others as well. Their influence on the development of Western philosophy is well documented, though most of their Socratic writings have been lost. What is surprising is the rich diversity of views that claim to draw directly out of Socrates' philosophy. Antisthenes, an Athenian and friend of Socrates, founded a school in Athens that taught that moral virtue is all one needs to be happy. He said the desire for anything else is irrational. Through Antisthenes and the like-minded Diogenes, one can trace the origin of ancient cynicism to Socrates. Aristippus of Cyrene, another acquaintance of Socrates, founded the so-called Cyrenaic school, which affirmed that the good life is the life of simple pleasure and the absence of pain. There are reasons to believe that Aristippus had an important influence on Epicurus. And if this is so, then Epicureanism also had its roots in Socratic philosophy. Aristotle himself must also be mentioned in this connection. He didn't know Socrates, but he did know a great deal about Socrates through his teacher, Plato. Socrates unmistakably influenced Aristotle, though Aristotle always added important qualifications to each of the Socratic positions he embraced. In general, Aristotle's solutions to ethical problems are often much closer to those of Socrates than to those of his own teacher, Plato. Finally, the founder of the Stoic school, Zeno of Citium, also did not personally know Socrates, but he must have known a great deal about him. When Zeno began writing and teaching in Athens at the end of the 4th century BC, the various doctrines of Socrates already were being frequently discussed and debated. Like Aristotle, Zeno was informed by a great many sources, but he embraced the unmistakably Socratic convictions that all human beings can think for themselves and that moral virtue is centrally important to happiness. Once Christianity had taken root in Europe, the debate about Socrates' importance shifted away from what he actually believed to whether his pagan views were compatible with the new religion. Justin the Martyr is typical of those who found Socrates to be an admirable figure. Writing to the Roman Senate in the 2nd century, Justin compared Socrates to the Christians, who were then being persecuted for resisting the official state religion.
There were those who were born before Christ assumed human form, who were also dragged into law courts as irreligious and meddling persons. When they tried, in human narrowness, to think out and prove things by reason. Socrates, the most ardent of all in this regard, was accused of the very crimes that are imputed to us Christians. They claimed that he introduced new divinities and did not believe in the official gods of the city.
But an early Christian named Tertullian frowned on Socrates, accusing him of being influenced by satanic forces.
All the wisdom of Socrates proceeded from the affection of an assumed composure rather than the firm conviction of an ascertained truth. For by whom has truth ever been discovered without God? By whom has God ever been found without Christ? By whom has Christ ever been explored without the Holy Spirit? By whom has the Holy Spirit ever been attained without the mysterious gift of faith? Socrates, as none can doubt, was actuated by a different spirit. For they say that a demon clung to him from his boyhood, the very worst teacher, certainly, notwithstanding the high place assigned to it by poets and philosophers, even next to, nay, along with the gods themselves. The teachings of the power of Christ had not yet been given, that power which alone can confute this most pernicious influence of evil that has nothing good in it, but is rather the author of all error and the seducer from all truth.
As Western civilization passed into the so-called Dark Ages, the little that was known about Socrates was transmitted by a few Roman writers, such as Cicero, who referred to him in passing. Even during the Middle Ages, a time when most of Plato's writings were being rediscovered in Western Europe, Socrates joined all the other ancient philosophers standing in the giant shadow cast by Aristotle. It was Aristotle's views that would dominate the European centers of learning until the modern age began. During the Renaissance, Socrates was once again held up as a model to be emulated. The French essayist René Montaigne wrote admiringly of Socrates' simple approach to pursuing the truth.
Socrates makes his soul move with a natural, an ordinary motion. A peasant says this, a woman says that. He talks only of horsemen, carpenters, cobblers, and masons. There are inductions and comparisons of the most common and familiar actions of men. Everyone understands him. beneath so vile an exterior, we would never have picked out the nobility and splendor of his admirable ideas. We, who estimate as low and base all that does not elevate science, and who recognize riches only in display and pomp.
Socrates has generally been cited with approval by philosophers since the Renaissance, even by philosophers who oppose one another. Both sides in a philosophical dispute have sometimes quoted or cited Socrates in support of fundamentally different views. For instance, the Danish existentialist philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, who had unshakable faith in the afterlife, praised Socrates for his fearlessness in the face of death.
To be sure, his was a tragic fate. And yet, the death of Socrates is not essentially tragic, since death had no reality for Socrates, and he faced it readily.
On the other hand, the great 19th century philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who's widely known for his pronouncement that God is dead, praised Socrates for his willingness to die rather than abandon his conviction.
That he was sentenced to death, not exile, Socrates himself seems to have brought about with perfect awareness and without any natural awe of death. He went to his death with the calm with which, according to Plato, he leaves the symposium at dawn, the last of the revelers, to begin a new day.
Today, Socrates continues to be the very symbol of intellectual integrity. His views about how to live also continue to be influential. Some ethicists have become dissatisfied with modern, rule-oriented approaches to ethics that sometimes seem to produce unacceptable results. Many ethicists have returned to a view of right action that focuses on good character, or what Socrates called virtue. According to this modern theory of virtue, right actions flow from such qualities as courage, benevolence, and justice. And in asking what these qualities are, or how they are to be acquired, philosophers once again are engaging in the very approach to philosophy that Socrates used when he interrogated people who thought they were wise, some 2,400 years ago.
This concludes Knowledge Products, The Giants of Philosophy. Socrates, narrated by Lynn Redgrave.